Good morning. It's Sunday, January 27th. The word frontier likely conjures images straight out of a John Ford Western. But what you may not be aware of is that if you reside in Western Kentucky, you may soon be living in an officially designated frontier yourself. Federal officials say classifying the purchase that way will help them assess things like access to services. Today, we'll speak with an area futurist about how being frontier could harm or help Western Kentucky on Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. I'm Todd Hatton.
And I'm Chad Lampe. We'll also speak with a Murray State alumna about a frontier of a different sort. The West African native is working in her home country to expand the horizons of the nation's young women. Then we'll get a report on a free clinic for Marshall County's working poor that may be close to completion, and look ahead to next month's MSU presidential lecture by director and producer Spike Lee. Those stories are ahead in the coming hour. The news from NPR is next. This is Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. I'm Chad Lampe.
And I'm Todd Hatton. You could say that the Jackson Purchase hasn't been frontier territory since Andrew Jackson was president. But now, here in the 21st century, the federal government is proposing a new system that would classify the purchase as frontier and remote, or FAR. Researchers and policymakers with the U.S. Departments of Agriculture and Health and Human Services say the new FAR area codes will help such regions improve access to public services as well as food and household goods. Futurist Ivan Potter is also the publisher of West Kentucky Journal, an online publication, and in a recent article, he wrote that even though this possible reclassification has slipped under the radar of most people, it could have significant and far-ranging effects. I spoke with Potter by phone to get a better sense of the pros and cons of living on the frontier. I'd like to begin by asking what exactly this FAR designation is and how federal officials are determining which parts of the country fall into that designation.
To understand this completely, we have to look at how federalism in America has worked. Now, federalism is a way where federal government has shared its monies back to communities and states for the past 30, 40 years. And one of the biggest problems in any kind of joint assessment of monies back to government has been urban and rural. How do you make a difference there? It used to be considered urban, all you needed was 2,500 population, and that's back in the 60s and 70s. And it's evolved now to a much more sophisticated approach, and now the latest round of designation has introduced, well, it's been around for a while, but introduced something called frontier and remote. And frontier and remote basically is a new way of judging rural populations, and their grading rules basically are how far it takes you from where you live to reach an urban core of 50,000 population. It used to be that would be simply look at a map and say, okay, it's within 45 minutes maybe by air time. Now they say, no, you have to consider driving time. Well, in rural areas, a lot of back roads, very few interstates. So that pushes the geography out a little bit longer. So in West Kentucky, Jackson Purchase especially, we are now being considered, our zip codes are being considered, in area codes, as frontier and remote. Even though I live 45 minutes from Murray and about 45 minutes from Paducah, neither one of those core urban areas are over 50,000 population. Therefore, we're all lumped in with Ozarks in the Missouri area. And for federal purposes, especially the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and within the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the Office of Rural Health, we are considered frontier and remote.
And what are they going to use this FAR designation for?
Good question, Todd. As in all federal regulations and new ideas, they start off with some maybe good points, but then as it evolves over time, it gets into a bureaucracy and it tends to take another life of its own. I see this as the end of federalism. Now, federalism is like I said before, a joint sharing of resources from our big brother in Washington down to states and locals and so forth. Kentucky was a leader back in the 70s. Kentucky, when we were presented a problem in the late 60s, early 70s, where there were about 1,200 to 1,400 federal programs had been created to do things with states and local government. Well, Kentucky had no way of handling that because most of our citizen leaders were unprepared to deal with the federal bureaucracy, and that's where the area development districts were formed. the ads. Area development districts were our answer to coordination with the federal government. And Kentucky, for about 10 years, was leader across the nation for this. Then about 1980, Reagan came in and started to cut programs, and that money started to dry up to where now, from starting really in 2000 to now, the federalism pot of money is pretty much gone from the golden days. So we're at a crucial crossroads here. We need infrastructure. We need everything you can think of a community. We need it to be fixed. And the only real source of money we have to look at is what we have here local. And, of course, that doesn't go very far. So America now stands at the edge of end of federalism and trying to figure out how do we pay for everything in an age when we're going to cut back even more. That's the biggest negative I see right now. And the other thing that's going to happen with frontier and remote designations for our area in the Jackson Purchase, not so much in Murray or Paducah, but out here where I live, we are just going to be further pushed into this bubble of isolation, the feeling that we're all alone and there's nowhere we can go, and that we're pretty much what we consider a throwaway community or a throwaway region within this civilization. So you got one negative being the federal government is pulling back in a big way. And then the other one is a mental, physical feeling out here among the people, and basically you're losing spirit as to who you are because you're now being called frontier.
It does sound as though it's a return to almost a pre-New Deal concept of the area.
Exactly. You got it right on the point. New Deal programs back in the 30s were meant to pull people out of their misery with no jobs, food was scarce, the spirit of the country was down. FDR came up with the new ideas, New Deal, and lifted basically the country out of that mess. Well, we're going back to it. We might not like it, but let me put a positive to this. I'm going to try to, I guess for lack of a better term, I'm going to wallow in this. I'm going to embrace this. I'm going to take this idea of frontier and isolation and remoteness, and I'm going to turn it to a tourism positive. I'm going to tell the Japanese and Chinese, if they want to see real America, you want to see how America got started, you come to the river counties of West Kentucky. You look at the river that pretty much gives life to all of mid-America. You look at a people who are bred as from frontier people from the early 1800s who carved out a civilization here when no one else would help them. This area, the Jackson Purchase, 1820s, was the last area bought by the federal government. That then, once it was included into the federal government, that was the closing of the first frontier. That was the point at which we had no longer a frontier east of the Mississippi River. The second frontier is when we went from St. Louis out to California. But what I'm telling you, Todd, is that we can claim here a third frontier is being formed. The third frontier is around water. It's around what we produce, food and fiber. For example, if we get smart as a region and embrace biomass, plants, biomass factories, if we come in and can grow hemp and other products that are high fiber content, we become overnight an energy capital. We can produce enough energy to get us off the grid. We're at a crossroads where if we don't do something soon, we're going to have towns shut down, towns go dark, lights go out. Or we can make this a place where we can entice people who want to retire into fun places. Don't be down with ourselves. Be proud we are frontier people. Let's look at our positives.
Well, are there any benefits that you see?
The biggest benefit I see is shaking the entire status quo. If we had leaders here, and I'm pretty much down on a lot of our government leaders because they don't do anything, they get in the way. We have legislators who have no idea the laws they pass, what the impacts are back at home, nor do they care. Most of our legislators in this area, except for the new ones who just got elected, are seeking retirement, early retirement, and away they go. We need bold leaders, people who are not afraid to stand up and say, look, we got a problem, let's try to fix it. And we have to get modern and realistic. Murray has just got a new German factory. Murray is going to be a hub of a cluster. The Germans move in a way to where if you got two plants there, you'll have five, and then you have five, you'll have eight. They cluster their culture within other cultures, which means that the areas around the lakes, which are wet now, you can buy liquor finally, You have a university, you have a culture, you have a nightlife. You have intelligent people working together. So Murray, I see, is our major shining star for the next probably two decades. It's going to draw in investment. Paducah is second in that. It will have a chance to do similar. But now you look at anywhere where there's heavy agriculture, if we don't modernize agriculture, we have to get away from just growing corn, wheat, and soybeans. We got to start processing things here, not just shipping it out. As long as we stay in the status of a third world country, then we're doomed. However, if we know this is a problem and can work towards it, then we can turn it around within 2 or 3 years. It's all about leadership. So I think the biggest positive coming out of this, it will force things to get so bad that our leaders will have no other choice but to lead.
You sound as though you're cautiously optimistic that being termed a frontier region is a temporary condition.
I think so. I think if you're sitting in Paducah and Murray, you think this is laughable. We're not a frontier. You look out the window, you see all this activity. But in America, let's take a line. If you draw a line on a map from Texas up to the Canadian border and you look east, it's about 200 million Americans. Now, where are they located? In about 7 centers. You got Chicago over to Pittsburgh area. You got Washington, D.C., New York up towards Boston. You got Atlanta, Georgia up moving up towards the Carolinas. You got South Florida. New Orleans has the Gulf Coast. Each one of those areas has 10 to 20 million people. They share one thing in common. Every day, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, they share one thing in common. They consume resources. Their food, their water is trucked in. We're sitting here in the middle of that. If you look at a map, Jackson Purchase, West Kentucky, is sitting in almost the exact center of 200 million people. Now, what we have to offer, we don't consume, we grow. We have fresh water. We produce food. We can make fiber. All the things everyone else needs, we could do it right here. So within 5 to 7 hours, the market's waiting for us if we know how to use it. So, yes, I see it all as being temporary. Again, if the Chamber of Commerce, the governor, the General Assembly can sit down with our local leaders, the ads as well, and decide we're not going to take it anymore. We're not going to be poor and ignorant. We're going to decide to be bold and innovative as our forefathers did as frontier. We will build a new frontier. This is all about hope. Most of our people who live here are hopeful people. They're good people. They just need good leaders who will stand up to the times.
Futurist Ivan Potter is publisher of West Kentucky Journal. Mr. Potter, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you for your opportunity.
Highway safety is a bit like the road signs that promote it. Both come in many shapes and sizes, and for more than a decade, a Lexington man has been arguing that there's not enough of either. Kentucky Public Radio's Stu Johnson reports on an activist who believes more and better road signs will make Kentucky highways and byways safer.
We have a highway memorial here, a burned-out tree here, another highway memorial there. Over my lifetime, I'm going to guess 15, maybe 20 people have died at that same spot, stretch of road.
Lexington resident Gerard Gerhard speaking recently to members of a local highway safety panel. Gerhard worked 30 years in Frankfort and has been fighting for better road signs over the past 10 years. He noticed time and again trucks on their side in what's known as the Northern Split, where Interstate 64 merges with Interstate 75 just north of Lexington. At Gerhard's urging, the state transportation cabinet did post additional signage. He still believes more could be done to alert drivers of that curve and others in the region.
What seems to be missing is advance warning signage on the one hand. In other words, before someone enters a very sharp curve, there needs to be advance warning of that curve. That's particularly true at night when people don't have the visual cues like tree lines and other things that they can see during the daytime.
Gerhard has made a study of roadways in central Kentucky that seem accident-prone. In many cases, he would like to see more arrows or chevrons marking a risky curve. The transportation activist is also credited with the addition of signage in and around a sizable curve on the connector in Frankfort. Among the people attending the Roadway Safety Coalition meeting was Julia Shaw, who's a traffic analyst with Lexington's Police Department. When investigating an accident, Shaw says police often overlook the role poor signage could have played.
Officers don't really pay attention to whether the signs or lack of warning signs could have contributed to the fact, because they may not even focus on that. So I think that's a really good point to bring up and to make officers aware of. Look around your surroundings and see if there's some other factor than maybe what they would think is the obvious of speed or impairment.
In Lexington, the Division of Traffic Engineering is responsible for assessing the effectiveness of road signs. Interim Director Jim Wood says they're always working to ensure signs provide the information and warnings needed by motorists.
We are going to reevaluate some of these locations and have evaluated some of them, but we're going to look at some of the other ones and perhaps try to get some money in the budget to try to cover some of these other areas, because it does cost more money to put up the signage. So it's something that we take very seriously. It's very important.
Additional signs sound like a good idea, but Chuck Wolf, who's with the State Transportation Cabinet, says traffic engineers must also watch out for signage fatigue.
Just number of signs isn't a cure-all. You just got to be able to convey the message and make wise use of your signage so that a driver doesn't subconsciously just tune it out.
Besides the effectiveness of adding signs, state traffic engineers must calculate the cost. Wolf notes some signage can cost thousands of dollars when taking into account installation and traffic flow impact. Critics argue the economic cost is minimal. Police traffic analyst Julia Shaw adds, if you can put down 5 or 10 signs and save a life, it's worth it. For his part, Gerard Gerhard still believes more can be done. He contends better signage can even aid drivers who are under the influence of drugs or alcohol survive a difficult turn.
The federal law certainly seems to be emphasizing that warning signs on the highways should address reasonable and prudent drivers, but not all drivers are reasonable and prudent, and they still die on the highways. We need to have warning signage to let motorists that don't know about unexpected conditions know what they're about to experience.
By doing a better job of warning drivers of the hazards they must soon navigate, Gerhard believes Kentucky can protect people and their property. It's a goal that he shares with traffic engineers and a vigil he promises to maintain. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Stu Johnson.
A free clinic for the working poor in Marshall County, long in the making, may be getting close to completion. When we come back, we'll take a look at what that will mean for Marshall. Then a conversation with an MSU graduate from Gambia who's using what she learned here to give girls in her home country a chance at a better education. This is Front Page Sunday from WKMS News.
You're listening to Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. I'm Chad Lampe.
And I'm Todd Hatton. A group of concerned Marshall Countyans have joined together to provide medical services for the county's people in need. And they want to provide those services for free. The Marshall County Free Clinic's mission is to provide professional medical care for people who otherwise couldn't afford it. Shelley Baskin speaks with MCFC Board Secretary Betsy McLean about the need for the clinic and also what the clinic needs.
So Betsy, could you tell me a little bit about what exactly the Marshall County Free Clinic is?
The Marshall County Free Clinic is being set up to serve people that are working and cannot afford or do not have access to insurance for medical care. There are so many people out there that fall between the cracks. They're going to work every day. They're trying to put food on the table and take care of their families. And with the price of medical insurance what it is, they just can't afford it. Therefore, if they have medical problems, they wait until things are in crisis mode and wind up at the emergency rooms at the hospitals. We're trying to do some frontline medical services to alleviate some of that and give these people that really deserve medical care some attention before it's completely out of control.
So what exactly would be the qualifications for somebody who wanted to get care from the Marshall County Free Clinic?
We will have income restrictions, which amounts to 200% of the national poverty level. It's based according to how many people are in the household and who's working. We cannot accept anyone that has insurance, disability, workman's comp, unemployment, or veterans benefits. Those people have access to insurance. And it's a sad situation because we can't cover all the people we really would love to cover. We have to draw the line somewhere, and it's not fair, but we just have to draw the line somewhere.
Who's going to be working in the clinic?
We have hired a medical director. Our medical director is Dr. Graham Smith. He'll be heading up the professionals list. We have an office manager that is Sharon Searles. Sharon served as head of the emergency room at the Marshall County Hospital for probably over 20 years. She retired and has graciously agreed to come and work for us and volunteer, and we are so thrilled to have her. We also have an assistant director, Kristen David. Kristen has a graphic arts background. She is just one big ball of energy. She is so talented. So we have our two paid employees, and the rest of it is volunteers, strictly volunteers, and we go from there.
So how would one go about becoming one of those volunteers that you're going to be looking for here soon?
You can pick up an application at the Marshall County Judge's Office. Judge Mike Miller and his assistant, Justin Lamb, has applications there that we need to have filled out. And we have all kinds of room for anyone that would like to volunteer in some way or another. Now, it might not be in the first 2 weeks, but don't worry, we'll find you a job. So stop by there. We also have a page on Facebook. You can go to Marshall County Free Clinic on Facebook, see what's going on there. And if you have any questions, we have a telephone. I'm not sure it is. Have a telephone. I'm not sure it's hooked up in the office, but as soon as we get that open, we'll be glad to make an announcement on that, too.
How's the clinic going to be funded? I understand one of the biggest things was trying to get enough money to open the clinic. So where is that money going to be coming from?
Well, our churches in Marshall County have been very, very supportive. We have applied for a 501c3 tax number. The application has not been returned to us yet, so we do not have our number. We cannot apply for a lot of grants and programs that are out there yet, but our churches and our individual donors have come through beautifully, and hopefully we are very, very close to having enough money to open and run us for a short period. We had a fundraiser back in the fall called a Mudison Run. I was not familiar with this at all, but it's a 5K race with obstacles. And I thought, nah, this is not going to do anything. We raised nearly $13,000 on that. Absolutely amazing. And this was in October.
So what's the near future look like? When are y'all planning on opening, and how long do you think you can stay open as you are?
It's one step forward and two steps back. We think we're just about ready to open, and then something else comes up, but it has to be done absolutely right when we do open. We want to have it as close to perfect as we possibly can because you're dealing with people's health and welfare. We hopefully can sustain ourselves with our donations, with our support from our churches, when our 501c3 does go through, then we can apply for several grants that are out there, but we will have to fund ourselves. Marshall County is truly a wonderful place, and when you hear someone say Marshall County takes care of their own, they do. This little tiny county, and it's not exactly at the head of the list income-wise, but we've managed to raise nearly $60,000 to get this thing open. And with the economy the way it is, I think that is phenomenal.
Betsy McLean is the Secretary of the Board for the Marshall County Free Clinic. Betsy, thank you for taking the time to talk to me, and I wish you the best of luck with getting the clinic open.
Oh, thank you so much.
Murray State graduate and former adjunct professor Yasin Sarr hails from the Gambia, West Africa. She and her husband, David Fox, have for the last 5 years been working to empower Gambian girls through education. Their organization, Starfish International, is working toward developing a comprehensive education program for girls from preschool to graduate school. While they were back in Murray for a visit, I spoke with Yasin about their work. Gambia, West Africa is relatively small. It has a population less than 2 million people. If you could, give me the bird's eye view, the social, political, and economic situation in Gambia.
The Gambia is the smallest country in Africa. That's saying a lot because the U.S. can fit into Africa three times. That's how huge Africa is. And so this is the smallest country with 1.5 million people. Even though it's that small, we have about 20 different tribes in the Gambia, 20 different ethnic groups with their own languages that are more different than English and French. So these are not dialects of each other, but separate languages. We have a government, a democratic government. It was a military takeover in 94, and then we've had civilian elections since then. The school system, the Gambia is 90% Muslim, but most of our educational system is made up of Christian schooling. So a lot of Gambians, it's not unusual for them to tell you that they went to Catholic schools or in my case, for example, I went to a Baptist kindergarten, a Methodist elementary school, and a Catholic high school. And so an example that's not too far from the U.S. is Christmas. So Christmas holidays and Christmas celebrations are very big in the Gambia. And so a lot of the Muslim families, a lot of the Muslim kids will go to church with their Christian classmates, for example, to celebrate it. So it's not divided religiously like Westerners are prone to thinking about religious divisions. So the basic thing about the Gambia is its friendliness. We don't have any gold, diamond, oil, elements, natural resources that make people fight a lot. We have our human resources, and we're on the westernmost coast of Africa. Therefore, it's a tourist attraction. So we our biggest industry other than agriculture is tourism.
And your description of Gambia sounds picturesque, and it sounds pretty nice to see the intermingling of religious cultures there. But there's obviously a problem with educating girls, or you wouldn't have Starfish International.
Right.
So what has prompted the need for your services among Gambian girls?
Well, when I give presentations in the U.S., I generally talk about education and educating girls from the perspective of the parents instead of the onlooker, for example. So the average Gambian makes about $1 a day. So if they worked every day of their life, they would make, during the year, $365. Education is free at the primary level, but at the secondary level, basic school fees for example, the high school, St. Peter's, in the village that we work with, cost about $100. So if a parent has four kids, if they wanted to just educate one child, one-third of their annual salary would go towards educating that one child. So it's not that parents don't want to educate their girls. It's usually that they have to pick a child or two to educate because they are just not making enough to educate all the children. And they normally pick the boys because the idea is that the girl gets married and moves away from the family to the family she's married into, and the boy gets married and brings their wife into the home. So the parents usually think, let's invest into this family instead of educating somebody and sending them to another family. So that's why they pick the boys. And then we're left with a majority of girls who get primary education, but their parents cannot afford to educate them at the secondary level. And those are the girls that we take and pay for their school fees and help educate them.
So it's not necessarily a deliberate persecution of girls within the country, but it's the parents thinking that they're choosing the lesser of two evils in their decision to educate their boys over their girls.
Right. And what we're doing at Starfish is we're taking the girls. So these are high-achieving girls with high financial need. And we say to the parents, we'll raise funds to pay for the school fees of these girls. And in return, we want you to give them some time off from their chores so that we can put them through an enrichment program. And one of the things that enrichment program does is help the girl start their own small business starting in seventh grade. So we work with seventh through 12th graders. And once the girl gets into the program, she has to start her own small business so that even though she's not paying for her own school fees, she starts paying for her school uniform, her backpack, some of her books, her shoes, her transportation back and forth, and her lunch money. And what that does is it creates an example of how much a girl can do if given an opportunity. So she's not a burden to the family anymore, because from seventh grade, she starts providing these things. And it kind of expands the parents' imagination as to what is possible. If this girl can do all this for herself between seventh and ninth grade, how much more can she do between ninth and 12th grade, and if I allow her to go to college?
What are community members saying about the program, because you're trying to change some of the views with their cultural norms?
Well, we're involved in things that directly empower the community. It's not something that they have to imagine. It's something that they can see. And that's very hard to argue with. Mm-hmm. So, for example, we have a photography class. So 15 of our girls run their own small business photography. We have soap making, body lotion making, lip balm making. We have a beekeeping class. We have embroidery. We have tie-dyeing. And right now we have a class that's starting to learn about basic cell phone repair. And so if you think about those, mm-hmm. those are all things that people need within the village or within their community. We also, because we do maternal health, we do basic first aid and CPR. We do basic human resource development and community health. For example, malaria, HIV, peer health education, those sorts of topics that we discuss. It's really easy for the community when they need something. Let's say somebody's bleeding profusely, you're trying to get to the community clinic. If there's a Starfish girl around, they can stem the flow of blood before you get there. And so these are things people can see, and that's hard to argue with. But we also educate them about how the education of a girl can help within the family to raise, and within the community to raise the community. So the analogy we use is two wings of a bird, which whether you're literate or illiterate, you can understand. And that is, if the family or the community is the bird, one wing is the male wing and the other wing is the female wing. If you want the bird to soar as high as it can, then you don't just have one strong wing. You want both wings to be strong enough. And right now, the female wing is weaker. So you want to strengthen it so your family can reach the heights that it should reach.
So considering that many of your practitioners are volunteer, or most, if not all, are, what are the funding needs of Starfish International? What keeps you going?
We started out in 2008. My mother-in-law, David's mom, had breast cancer. And I had shaved off my head in solidarity with... Mm-hmm. Shaved off my hair in solidarity with her, and people started treating me like I had cancer. and so at some point, I started thinking, what if it were me? What if I had been the one going through cancer, breast cancer? What would I regret not having done in my life? And what I would have regretted not having done was gone back to my community to follow up on my dream of working with girls. So what we did was emailed everybody on our email list, and we said, look, if you go out to eat, let's say, once a week and you spend $25, if you give up four meals at a restaurant, you could sponsor a girl for a year. And so about 50 of our friends signed on to sponsor a girl for a year, and it was between $100 and $150. And we, with that, we went and we got the girls. So funding needs, we still do the same thing. Every year we come and we look for people who would want to sponsor individual girls. So funding needs range from classroom space. We borrow classroom space from the local high school that I went to that these girls are going to. It ranges from school fees for the girls. We educate 100 girls every year, so that's $10,000, to hoping to raise funds to build a building so the girls can just sit in there and have their classes there. We're now in the process of building a business center so the girls can sell all their wares in one central location rather than dividing it and each selling them individually. So if you go to the website, starfishinternational.org, or you look us up on Facebook, you can see all the projects that the girls are doing and where we need help. We have no government funding right now, and we're not big enough. We just started, so we're not big enough to apply for huge grants. Mm-hmm. And so it's just individually based.
And is this how you and David make your living as well? I mean, how do you stay afloat personally?
That's a good question. Until this year, I was teaching at Syracuse University. I had an assistantship there, and I was doing my PhD. I finished all the coursework, and I'm writing the dissertation. So until then, our money was coming from David is a clinical psychologist. So he was working as a clinical psychologist, and I was working as a teacher. And then this year, now that I've finished my coursework, we want to do Starfish full-time. So this year, we just have to get the word out and work really hard and hope people invest in Starfish, and then Starfish could hopefully pay us.
Well, Yasin Sar with Starfish International, Berea College alumna and Murray State University alumna, thank you very much for your time and your visit here at WKMS.
Thank you for having me. Go to our Facebook page. I've learned that it's good to be liked. So go there, starfishinternational.org, and like us and see what projects the girls are doing and where you can plug in and let us know your passion and sponsor a girl.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you. Coming up after the break, a look ahead at the upcoming Murray State University presidential lecture from acclaimed director, writer, and producer Spike Lee. Lee will speak February 4th at Murray State's Lovett Auditorium. This is Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. This is Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. I'm Chad Lampe.
And I'm Todd Hatton. Director, writer, and producer Spike Lee presents this year's Murray State University presidential lecture Monday, February 4th at Lovett Auditorium on the MSU campus. His films include Do the Right Thing, She Hate Me, Malcolm X, and When the Levees Broke. Attorney Crystal Coleman is director of the Speech and Debate Union in the Department of Organizational Communication at Murray State. Dr. Jeff Osborne is associate professor of English at MSU and directs the Jesse Jones Writing Center. Both of them watch a lot of Spike Lee, and they're looking forward to Lee's presentation. The two join Kate Lochte for a conversation about the filmmaker.
We're here today your term, Jeff, to situate Spike Lee's contribution to culture. And you both thought that starting off with Do the Right Thing would put us on good footing.
Sure. Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I love Spike because I grew up with Spike Lee, basically, and coming from an historically black college and university, and Hampton University, I am a third generation Hamptonian, where, of course, Booker T. Washington went and also taught. And so it was interesting because our generation growing up in the 70s and 80s, just there were no real black filmmakers out there creating our stories. And that's what he did. He's definitely the person who paved the way for John Singleton and others, Tyler Perry, to come in and create movies. And I think he prides himself, and he should, on being the one to do that. As far as the starting off with Do the Right Thing, the thing that I love about that particular movie is that we as a people have been discussing police brutality for years. And everyone knows about Gates in California and the African-American people out on the West Coast. But regardless, what I love is that we've always said there's been police brutality. And we kept saying it and saying it, and people and weren't listening as an entire group of people of Americans. And so what he did was he had this movie that depicted, hello, we are getting killed, we're getting beat up. Some are being beat up because they're into illegal behavior, but some of us, racial profiling is going on just because of this or just because of that. So it was really a brutal, when they picked him up and he strangled him to death, and it was crazy, but it also was like, this is not really that unusual. And then the riots, the anger of people and everything had to be shown, because everyone's like, well, they're just angry and they're tearing up their own things. You know, we think of Watts, the riots. People, often in history, the only way the public will take notice is if you do something drastic. Nobody wants to have to do that, but you're not listening. So maybe if we bang up some stuff, we can get you out of your houses, get you to turn on the TV and listen to the cries we're trying to make. And it was powerful. So I love that movie. I've seen it a million times. Of course, I'm exaggerating. But, Jeff, I'm exaggerating. But I've seen it a lot. So he raises the consciousness and gets people to finally open their eyes and say, wow, okay, we're listening. We may not agree, but we're listening.
Yeah, I think for me, I didn't grow up on the East Coast or in an urban area. I grew up in a place much like Murray.
Right.
And so that film kind of came out of nowhere for me. I mean, representations of African Americans on television for me were like the Huxtables. And insofar as I'd been exposed to discussions of race relations, was really,
which was probably
not
very
to be cute,
little,
but a very black and white, you
right,
know, like
right.
Slavery was really bad,
right,
you know,
right, the
civil
basics.
Rights really good.
Right.
And then Spike Lee comes along and you realize that these issues are a lot more complicated than we might have thought before. And so, yeah, I think Do the Right Thing for me was, just like you said, there were no black filmmakers really
none.
Before Spike Lee
really?
Who treated these issues.
No, but, right,
no, no, but
right, correct.
And in a very provocative way. And I still think he's good at that.
Yeah, that's
to
what
provoke
he does.
Discussion. Yeah.
Sure, sure.
And you reminded us, Jeff, that Do the Right Thing came out in the same year as Driving Miss
oh, right,
Daisy.
Yeah.
And
right.
It's really a stark difference in the art of filmmaking.
And Do the Right Thing, which is, you know, considered to be one of the greatest films of the 80s and
yes,
90s,
yes.
wasn't even nominated for Best Picture in the same year that Driving Miss Daisy won. And I think when you look at those two films and the way race relations are represented, it does say a whole lot.
It says a whole lot. We won't get into the whole Oscar thing. I don't want to go fully there, but again, often we are a little disgusted for Denzel winning for Training Day, but not for Malcolm X, when we thought he was just phenomenal.
Right.
And the movie was phenomenal and raised the consciousness of young people, especially young African-American people, because it depicted Malcolm much more than just this person, this polar opposite of MLK. They actually had many discussions and they had a lot of ideology that was together. It's just that there were some little differences that the media portrayed as stark differences, as always, to try to get us to fight among each other kind of situation. And that movie was amazing. And yet he wins for Training Day as the thuggish cop kind of thing. And, you know, there's so many things I can talk about with that. But I like Jeff's point. Driving Miss Daisy won, but Do the Right Thing didn't. It's one of those things back in Arsenio makes you go, Basically,
right.
It's doing what Spike is trying to say happens often in the country, which is let's ignore the significant stuff and let's just concentrate on the stereotypes and what have you. So
yeah, it's a lot easier to do that.
It sure
I think
is.
For people,
sure
they want things to be really clear cut. And I think what Spike Lee does in his films is really kind of amazing, that whether explicitly or implicitly, history and American history is always there, and the messiness of it and the complexity of it. And so even in a film like Malcolm X, which is such a brilliant movie, you know, the first third of the movie is really like, you know, Harlem in the early 20th century.
Sure.
and what insight the
sure.
movie provides.
Sure.
That's right.
It's giving you touches of history along with the message. Because like you said, kids in rural areas, there's no Black history or hardly any, really, any kind of history that's really depicted absolutely correctly. It's all watered down and mm-hmm. black and white. Like you said, this is what happened and this was good, this was bad. But you never get into the complexities because the history books are incomplete. And I hate even saying the Black history. It should be just history.
Right.
You know, but they didn't teach history. They taught little pieces of history that had nothing really to do with anyone else, but specifically Caucasian people.
Yeah.
It's like,
and I think,
hello.
And as you know, we've come a long way since 1989.
Absolutely.
And I think that Spike Lee is responsible for at least some of that. I mean,
absolutely.
Yes, just an awareness of history.
Is he a provocateur in his documentaries as well? You've seen them, Jeff. I have not.
Yeah, I think that he is a provocateur. Well, I think that his documentaries provoke. I think maybe provocateur maybe suggests someone who may just do it
like some narcissist.
But yeah, I mean, I think the documentary When the Levees Broke and the documentary Four Girls, which
Four
was about
girls.
The 63,
Birmingham.
The Birmingham
yep.
church bombings. I mean, they're provocative in a number of ways. Spike Lee's take on the events of the levees breaking and the people who were interviewed and their anger is very provocative. But just the heavy emotional content of
but
these
it's
documentaries
very real.
Is... right.
He consulted with the living parents of the kids who were killed in Birmingham.
Yeah.
He didn't just do it like a narcissist would do it just for the... you know, for the heck of it. He made sure, are you okay? Am I telling this story about your daughter correctly? You
right.
know, he's responsible in his filmmaking. That's why I respect him, because I know he's trying to tell the story, not just for the fluff and for the box office ratings, but to tell the story so that people will wake up and see the issues we've had that lead into why we still have some of them.
Where do you put him in the world of art?
I think he has a very important place in the history of cinema, for sure. And I think part of the message, too, that he will bring with him when he speaks is that to be successful for Spike Lee means to follow his dreams, to be an artist. I don't think making money is that important to him. So I think you can right. see this in his films, even the ones which became really successful by Hollywood standards. But if you look at a film like Do the Right Thing, I mean, visually speaking, that film kind of comes out of nowhere and had so much influence on the visual vocabulary of films in the 90s.
Yeah.
I mean, just the colors and the editing,
yes.
The mixture of like comedy and drama and these characters you had never really seen before in film. And not just because they're powerful Black characters, but I mean, Mookie is a character that there's no real precedent for him.
Right.
So I think artistically speaking, I think he's really important. And he's made lots of really great, engaging movies, like
yeah.
like 25th Hour with Ed Norton, about a guy who's about to go to prison, is an amazing film.
I loved the camera work, even in the movies, School Days and mm-hmm. also Do the Right Thing. I loved the little piece with the stereotypes being blurted out by the Asian grocery owner and then mm-hmm. Mookie, and then everybody. I thought that was hilarious, because this is what people are thinking, but political correctness keeps them from saying publicly. Now, they're saying it in the homes among their friends, but nobody's out there calling anybody, at least the smart people aren't, out there using racial slurs for everybody to hear. But he was, and the way the camera zoomed in and zoomed out, I just love that. I love the camera work as a mass media person.
Have either of you heard anything about what Spike Lee does when he comes out and just talks for an evening? Do you know what to expect?
No, and that's what I love. He's always thinking, and I love that. He knows exactly what he's doing. He knows exactly what he's going to do before he gets here. In the moment, he'll do what he wants to do. I have no idea what Spike's going to do. He could come off super militant, or he can say, you know what? I'm going to rural Kentucky where they're going to expect me to be militant, and I'm going to just stand up here straight, Morehouse, intellectual, and answer questions.
Yeah, he's such an astute social critic. I mean, it may depend on what's happening, you know, that in the days leading up to the talk.
On the cab ride.
Right. Yeah, it's going to be really amazing, I think, you know, no matter what he talks about. Mm-hmm. People are going to leave wanting to talk about what Spike Lee talked about. Right. I mean, I think he's going to leave everyone with something to think about, to talk about, to mull over.
Which is what I respect, is he does not demand that you like him. I don't agree with every little thing he does. Like I said, I went to a historically black university. I definitely saw characters in School Days whom I knew and even saw myself in some of the characterizations. But I don't agree with every little thing, but who cares? Who has to?
Thank you both for making us all think today.
Thanks, Kate.
Our pleasure. Thanks, Kate.
Filmmaker Spike Lee's presidential lecture at Murray State University is at 7:30 p.m. Monday, February 4th in historic Lovett Auditorium.
After more than 4 years of bringing you news and issues from around our Four Rivers region, we're bringing Front Page to a close. We're transitioning, though, into a new way of bringing you those stories as part of our continuing commitment to thought-provoking and insightful news and information. We'll present episodic, hour-long programs that focus on specific topics and issues beginning March 3rd with a look at our region's railroads. Our correspondents have been Drew Adams, Shelley Baskin, Whitney Jones, Casey Northcutt, and John Walker.
Kate Lochte is a contributing producer, and Matt Markgraf provides website assistance. If you have questions or comments about what you've heard today, email us at msu.wkmsnews@murraystate.edu. You can also have your say on our Facebook page, and there is a link to that at our website, wkms.org, where you can also hear any of today's features again. We'd also like to extend a very special thanks to you, the listener, for joining us over the last 4 years. You've been listening to Front Page Sunday from WKMS News.